Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 2, Episode 5, Rebecca. We learned a little bit of backstory about Chuck this time. A little bit of backstory about Jimmy, too, with their father and stuff.
Well, were these true facts?
Right? Right? Very good question, which we will get to. What did you think of the episode in general?
Well, I cheated, because I don't know whether you bullshitted me or not, because last night on the cocktails with Jim and Aaron, I said, what am I in for on Better Call Saul tonight? Because usually I watch it live. I wasn't able to for a variety of reasons. And you said, it's okay. I really enjoyed it. Enjoyed it more than I thought I would enjoy a very Kim-centric episode.
And a pretty slow one. You know, it's not particularly funny. It's not... I don't know. It was kind of a meh episode for me the first time around. Second time around, I did enjoy it a little bit more. I was background watching it the first time. So maybe that had something to do with it. This is not an easy episode to background watch because there's no big bombastic moments, right?
No. I was just fascinated by what all Ray Seahorn was doing in her mini Kim-tages that she had.
Sure.
And, just the silent performance she was doing. Like, you could see her mind working and calculating everything that Chuck was saying to her in the scene. So there's a lot of quiet moments like that. And then you got Mike versus Tio coming out of no. I mean, that merited pretty good, I thought. Like, that just came out of nowhere with the haymaker.
Right. It's an interesting scene that I want to talk quite a bit about once we get there. There was some insight into it on Reddit that I found. A lot of interesting stuff happening there.
Okay.
But I don't know. We'll the second time around, like I said, it was much better. I paid attention to it, so maybe that's why. Overall, good episode of television.
I do want to tease some content that's coming just before the feedback break. We actually got a chance to sit down and talk with Max Arciniega, who plays Crazy 8. Last week's Better Call Saul and also Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
I thought it was a nice, entertaining little interview. So that'll be coming up in probably about an hour, knowing us.
Yeah, he's an easy guy to talk to.
But, if you're like, this is Aaron and Jim bullshit, fast forward to the good stuff.
Right. Okay, well, let's get into the recap. We start off with Chuck and his wife, Rebecca. It's implied that they had a wedding recently and Jimmy missed it. They're preparing the house for dinner and Jimmy's arrival.
I think it's clear that she's his wife. And also, if
it
you...
It is, yeah.
There was some speculation about the sheet music that Chuck was playing a few weeks ago to the metronome. And
right.
The title of the music was Rebecca Boys.
Oh, the name written on it? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, was it the name or is it the title? Like,
it wasn't a title.
Okay.
There was a name pinned
okay.
on the sheet music.
So he was... That's, clearly... We're starting to understand how Chuck became the way Chuck was, because he certainly wasn't afraid of electricity in this episode.
Yeah, he's changing light bulbs. He's...
What did you think of the... Because I usually praise the lighting on this show. There was something that went wrong, and they tried to maybe fix it with a filter, and it just made it seem like this thing was filmed in squid ink. Like, they filled it, the aquarium tank full of squid ink. And
shot
put a button and shot through it because it just looked muddy and ugly.
You're right. I didn't like the lighting in this scene at all.
It was
hard to see anything. And I don't know what effect they were going for. Like, because oftentimes in a flashback, you'll have a different type of lighting to indicate that it's a flashback.
Now, honestly, this is the kind of shit that I'd expect to see in Penny Dreadful when you're in some dark castle and you're following Frankenstein's monster through it. But there was a bunch of digital effects that they added to that. And this show does lighting so well. I don't know. The inside didn't mention anything about it being a fiasco on Insider Cast.
I only got to listen to half of it. Not enough to. They talked a lot about lighting, but they talked about it from the perspective of Chuck ripping out all the lighting.
Yeah.
So I'm really not sure. They were clearly going for a vibe, and it does kind of leave me off kilter watching this scene.
Sure.
I'm feeling very uneasy, but I didn't like it aesthetically, honestly.
No, me either. And maybe you're not intended to, but I don't know. I feel like lighting something that you do it for effect, but you either shouldn't notice it or you should notice and be like, wow, this is really nice and amazing.
Yeah, I ended up maybe seeing it too much and not feeling it quite enough. Mm.
Yeah. Anyway.
I don't know.
Rare misfire, in my opinion.
Yeah. So they set up this signal where she can pull her ear like Burnett.
What's Carol
her
Burnett. First
name? Carol Burnett.
Yep.
A little before my time. I looked this up. Apparently, Chuck never gets around to actually saying it, but the reason she pulled her ear is to let her grandmother know she was doing all right on her shows.
Right. Before my time, too, but my ex-mother-in-law was a huge fan, and she had, like, all these, like, VHS tapes of it, and I got to watch, and, like, I gotta say, like, Carol Burnett and Tim Conway, pretty fucking hilarious.
Okay.
Especially since they did, I like it when people crack up and they can't get through their own jokes. Like, I find that's contagious, and they did that maybe too much on the show, but that's right up my alley.
Right. Yeah, those variety shows were kind of known for that. Those live type variety shows. Anyway, so the signal's there to say, hey, I've had enough of Jimmy. Mm-hmm. Let's get rid of him. Jimmy shows up. They have their dinner, and he begins talking about a couple of things. His first week in the mailroom, he talks about Rebecca being a musician and missing their wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And then he starts telling lawyer jokes, which makes Chuck very uncomfortable.
Yeah, like two
Chuck
jokes in, he starts
pulling his ear.
Pulling the ripcord, and no parachute comes out.
But Rebecca is too entertained by Jimmy to actually notice that he's trying to pull the ripcord. Once Jimmy leaves later that night, they sit in bed and they talk about their upcoming days. And Chuck tries to tell a lawyer joke, tries to sort of emulate Jimmy and steal maybe a little bit of the spotlight from him back.
Lead balloon.
Doesn't work. It doesn't quite land in the same way that Jimmy's did.
So I have a whole bunch of subtext ponderings here.
Okay.
I want to try it on you. First thing is, was Jimmy being thoughtful by bringing a six-pack of brew from the hometown to their dinner? Or was he, like, just wanting to bring something he knew he would drink, even though he knows Chuck doesn't really like it? Or is Chuck an asshole for snubbing his gift, because in the next scene, pointedly, he's drinking wine while Jimmy's drinking the brews?
It's hard to tell, but I think it's effective. Him showing up with these brews, I think, reads a couple of different ways.
That's what I'm saying. Like, they do an amazing job of staying so, like, right on, just walking along the top of the fence about which side you're on.
With this entire scene, I mean, Jimmy's being nothing but nice, right? And Chuck is getting angry about that.
Sure.
He's feeling left out. He's feeling inferior to Jimmy in some weird way, because Jimmy's charismatic and he can make people laugh.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's been a thing with their characters. Sure. Chuck has come out and said it. Look, people like you, you make them laugh, but that doesn't make you a good lawyer.
Well, it's not just, it's like the big fish phenomenon, you know, like, this guy's dad is this storytelling, charming. Like, you meet him for the first time, he's the greatest guy ever. And the whole time, his son's wanting to blow his head off because he knows the downside and the exhausting side of this personality, too.
Sure.
And, like, you know, Chuck's always walking around ready to boil. Like, his pot is just ready to boil over with Jimmy's bullshit. Whereas a person who's never, you know, had the water get heated up, it takes him a lot longer. So, like, I feel like it's interesting how out of touch Chuck is with his wife here, because he's like two jokes in. Oh my god, this guy's just never going to stop. We got to get him out of here. Where his wife's just warming up to him.
Yeah.
The other thing is, Jimmy funny in this scene? Because I thought not only were the jokes not that funny, but him trying to sell it and his wife's reaction felt false to me.
I think it's his mannerisms, the way he presents things. I don't think the jokes are meant to be funny. Like,
but he's selling them with his, like, bam, pow, there it is. Like, he's Emerald cooking something spicy in the kitchen, and I'm like, this joke could not be milder. It does not deserve the spice that you're putting on it.
Right, but I think that's why it's so effective when Chuck tries to do the same thing and just fails miserably. Hmm. And she's just like, oh, you're telling a joke. Hmm. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, it's just,
I thought it created a good contrast.
I know
what
Bob
two.
Odenkirk when he's funny. He's funny a lot.
Yeah.
But I felt like they fell into a trap of like, oh, well, we'll just have him tell a bunch of conventional jokes and do some shtick and it'll be funny. I actually kind of got like, oh, man, Rebecca seems dull. Like, if she's rolling in the... Are we supposed to get that?
I think you're supposed to get that Chuck is dull.
Hmm.
Like,
but she's the one laughing at these lame jokes and egging on Jimmy.
But I feel like she's laughing with Jimmy. Like, Jimmy is the attraction here, not the fucking joke.
I don't think
care.
I'm getting... I must not be expressing what I'm trying to express, and that's cool.
Right.
The other thing...
I get the impression that Rebecca is maybe not entirely satisfied with her life with Chuck.
Really?
From this. Like, because she comes to light. Like, you can see every moment she's with Chuck, she's just very, like, serious and like, almost down a little bit.
Hmm.
And then when she's around Jimmy, she starts laughing and coming to life. And that's Jimmy bringing that out of people. I get it. But maybe she would desire a little bit
kinda,
more.
It felt a little bit like when Rose goes with Jack in the steerage on the Titanic. It's like, and I know Rose is deeply unhappy with her life. Yeah. But I feel like Chuck and Rebecca have this like successful urbane. She's the violinist and he's the successful lawyer. And they do big time shit and they go to Italy and have real Italian food. And, and you know, they got all these experiences and they're just like conducting a symphony in the kitchen. I feel like they're very happy and content. But you and Jimmy comes by and like suddenly the fiddle comes out and the hornpipe and you're, you know, thumping a thub and it's
yeah, he's
like
stirring the pot a little.
You wouldn't want to do that
right
forever. But it's nice to kind of roll in the mud. Like,
that's true.
Like Jimmy's trying to get Chuck to do last week. Last thing. Do we glean any insights from Chuck's managerial style? Because in my household, it's something of a controversy about who is behind the persecution of one Kim Drexler.
I
noticed he's
on the internet at large.
Okay.
It's also a controversy.
Okay. Maybe it'll be a controversy in this very studio. But I thought that there was a lot of him making pointed comments to his wife about, well, you can't let her affect the quality of the work versus, well, you got to be a team player and you got to think about morale and people's spirits. Did you get any insight into Chuck from these? And again, we don't know what the subject was. We don't know what it was about. We don't know anything. But I thought that there was a little bit of more of his kind of uncompromising stand with people coming through there.
Yeah, maybe so. He does kind of push her in a direction, certainly. But I think also the scenes later on with Kim, where they sit down and talk,
yeah,
that actually kind of pushes it the other direction for me. I think unless Chuck is just straight up lying to her and smiling, you know, falsely, I think he probably didn't have as much to do. Because Howard comes off kind of in the opposite light this time.
Yeah, but I'm explaining this, I feel foolish because I realize how much of my theories are based entirely on like
the latest
subtext
information
stuff. No,
oh,
just like
okay.
Looks on faces and little minute sounds people are making. So I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy.
There's a lot of stuff with that in Howard and Chuck's conversation too. But
sure,
we'll get there.
That's, yep.
Big question for you.
Uh-huh.
Huge question. Where's Rebecca now?
She's dead.
She's dead.
I think she's dead.
She didn't run off to
Italy
for better risotto.
That they're super, yeah. If your theory is that they're unhappy together, then I guess she left.
Right. I mean, there is also the illness. Chuck's illness could be a big motivating force for her not being around.
Well,
anymore.
But they see what came first.
Right.
I would say
right,
that
it's a chicken or egg. We don't know
her leaving or departing or dying. Whatever would lead him to have his breakdown where
he
could have a breakdown and then she's just like,
yeah,
fuck this, I'm out.
Right.
So I don't know. Insufficient information. But my guess is because Jimmy and Chuck never acknowledge it. And I'm like, okay, is that more likely if someone died or if someone left you? Because if someone left, that's kind of, I guess, intrinsically more embarrassing, something you don't want to bring up.
Yeah, that implies your fault. Whereas
if someone's dead and it's been a few years, it's almost like healthy. It's been 4 years, at least 4 years, because Jimmy's a 4-year associate. And we know that he has yet to go through law school because he started doing that. So like we're probably 6, 7, 8 years out from that. So I don't know.
Yeah. All right, well, I bring that question up so that we can talk later and I can speculate.
Okay.
I can walk on the wild side and really fucking speculate. Chuck calls Kim to tell her that he thinks he can get her... Wait, Chuck doesn't call Kim. Jimmy calls Kim. Says, hey, I think I can get you back on HHM's good side. She doesn't answer her phone.
Uh-huh.
But he's got a scheme brewing. And when he's printing some papers, he runs into Aaron, who has many notes on the style of his writing, some brand notes. She insists that they review them all right now. Jimmy says, okay, sure, I'll meet you in the conference room. Walks out the back door when she's not looking. You think this is punitive, or is this just something that Cliff takes very seriously?
I think that, as Cliff threatened last episode, Jimmy is under a great deal of scrutiny.
Yeah.
And it's colorful aspects of his personality that they were willing to overlook, they're no longer willing to overlook. And I think a little bit of it is punitive.
Yeah.
Like, look, if we can't trust you to follow the big rules, we're going to go right back to basics, man.
Yeah.
So,
and also, they are very concerned about the brand, right? I mean, that was their big problem is with the commercial he made.
Sure.
Is it's not on brand. And I think, you know, going back to basics on that, like you said, and saying, you know what, now we need to talk about your indentation and your capitalization.
Well, the other thing is
the way you write your briefs.
Again, I'm reading between the lines here, and I'm getting a little bit of opinion that Jimmy's core lawyering maybe not be up to snuff. Because she's essentially accusing him of cut and paste lawyering.
Right, like, you know,
when you're quoting, you shouldn't quote, because it almost seems like you don't know how to make your own legal argument.
Right.
Like, is he the version of a guy who just cuts and pastes other bits of working code and kludges a bunch of shit together and, like, there it is versus
works.
A guy. Yeah, like, I got more than a little bit of that from him, too.
Okay.
Which, you know, I think it's fair to say at this point that he's not the world's greatest lawyer. He's more of a showman than a deal maker. So writing legal briefs and doing legal opinions, probably not his strongest suit. Especially, I mean, good God, look at the guy hunting and pecking. Like, anytime I see someone typing like that, I'm like, how the frustration of that slow input's got to be killer. I mean, that got you cutting and pasting more than anything.
Yeah, that's true. I couldn't handle it. While we're at the Davis main office, I do want to talk about the office itself for a little bit, because they in the Insider cast, they talk a lot about in the lobby, which we didn't see this episode, but we saw last episode. There's this big old painting behind the desk to kind of cover the fact that this is a library, and they're covering a bookshelf with it.
The library. See, I would have guessed a steakhouse or hotel.
Right.
Library, huh?
It's a library, yeah.
Okay, I can see that.
So they put up this big piece of street art that they kind of modified, and the original work of art was red. And hear me out on this. They say that they changed the colors of that because red in Vince Gilligan says red in this universe indicates criminality.
Okay, sure.
So Vince Gilligan's on the color theory. I'm on the color theory.
All right,
you gotta be, because they are.
I'll just gaze into the middle distance while you guys talk about it.
Right. I knew you weren't gonna care too much about that, but. You know, there's a little bit more, I don't know, wood on the fire for that.
All right.
Kim's working late on her doc reviews.
She's a machine cranking this out.
Yeah, she's working later than anybody. Jimmy continues to call. She continues to ignore him. Some underlings here ask if they can leave, and Kim says, hey, I'm not your supervisor, so they head out, leaving the fucking music on. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with these fools?
Maybe they think she's enjoying it, because I actually thought that was something she was listening to. I'm like, all right, that's some good doc review music. Keep you going when it's getting close to midnight.
Right, but like, I feel like when you're ready to leave, you shut the music off.
No, I get it.
Assuming,
totally.
If you're assuming she's going to leave as
or
well.
Or you ask her, hey, you want me to leave the radio on?
Right.
Are you enjoying
they
this?
They just leave with the radio on. So she settles in for an even later night when Jimmy tries to call again, and he decides, hey, I'm going to stop at HHM to tell her that she needs to sue them.
This is ridiculous. I mean,
she says, that's insane.
Tells
him, stop trying to help me. I'm going to do this myself.
I mean, this,
do your own job.
I mean, she...
Self-righteous... Some righteous anger here from Kim. I think Jimmy is a fool.
He is so out of touch with the way she wants to do things after the last 2 weeks to come in here and suggest a lawsuit.
And it's just another example of Jimmy thinking short term. Like, I'm going to put a Band-Aid on this and fix it. That doesn't help anything.
She's
her
like,
career would
even
be
even if I win,
over.
My career's over.
Yeah.
And that's not what I want. I want to be a lawyer, Jimmy.
Yeah.
I want to be a successful corporate lawyer. I don't want to be whatever the hell you're trying to be. No, it's great. the line, you don't save me, I save me, really great. And I, again, that's like, it's shit like this that makes me want to believe the stories about Jimmy taking money out of his dad's till.
Right. That's a very short-sighted thing to do as well. There's a lot of, I guess, not direct argument, but a lot of assertion here as to who is to blame for Kim's current predicament. Is it Howard? Is it Chuck? Kim thinks it's Howard. Jimmy thinks it's Chuck. I feel like this is a reflection of the audience at large. Sure. Who's to blame here?
But ultimately, Kim comes back to, it's your fault, asshole.
Right, which is totally correct. 100% yes. Irrefutably correct.
Yep.
I really love how Jimmy kind of has this shorthand with the maintenance guy now.
Uh-huh.
Just, again.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm coming in again.
Yep. The ink blotter.
Do you think, okay, so as Jimmy is presenting this lawsuit, these documents that he's drawn up,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, is that a smart thing to do? It feels like the commercial all over again. He has jumped the gun. He has prepared a filing of a lawsuit that she can just hand in, mm-hmm. like he did his commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any chance this comes back to haunt her?
Like, how?
If they see these documents lying around, because there's no indication that Jimmy wrote these, right? Like, it says Kim Wexler versus HHM.
Did,
like,
you pay attention to the final deposition or wherever the... God, I'm trying to use a word that I don't know.
Disposition?
Yes. Did you see where those landed?
I didn't.
I mean, maybe. I feel like that
would
be...
I meant to look for it, but I don't think they ever indicated it firmly.
I think that wouldn't be very interesting, because that's like almost sitcom kind of, you know, level of plot. That's like shit you'd see on 6th season of Friends in a fairly forgettable episode of...
Yeah,
you know,
I guess so.
Ross writes a letter to his mother where he's getting all his angry feelings, and Rachel finds it and thinks it about her, and oh my god, it's like, nah, I don't really want to see HHM go down that route. There's enough axe to be ground just on what's happening.
Right, right.
So, no, I hope that's not what they're going with.
Yeah, I didn't see where those landed, but certainly a possibility that stuff's out there.
The other thing is, like, I would hope that Chuck and Howard could tell the difference between a Kim brief and a Jimmy brief. So if she says, Jimmy wrote that, I told him to go fuck himself, that's why it hasn't been filed in court.
Yeah.
It seems like even if she didn't sign it, that there'd be material differences in the way they were written.
Probably. Maybe Aaron's going to write up some notes on it.
Sure.
So Jimmy arrives at his office, where Aaron is waiting for him the next morning.
He's got GERD.
Yeah, he lies to apologize to her, and then she calls him on it, and they get down to business.
I got to say, I don't fault him for ducking her.
No, it's late. Like, this is not the time for this.
Yeah, and you're just a set. I don't care if Cliff put you up to this. Until I hear from himself that he wants me to stay until midnight to work with you,
yeah.
Fuck off.
Right. And I don't even think he owes her an apology. I mean, he could have just said, no, I'm not doing this tonight.
Sure.
Go home. So maybe he does owe an apology for just ducking.
I felt like that was about appropriate to the level of...
Yeah.
The aggression,
right?
You know, like, it's she was being fairly aggressive and pushy and
very aggressive,
and apparently she's got a blank check for this kind of stuff from Cliff, but still,
yeah,
you know.
So we go to Kim's lunch break. She's making a bunch of calls trying to drum up new business for the firm in order to get back on Howard's good side,
dialing for dollars,
or Chuck's good side, depending on what you think.
Sure.
She has no luck, so it's back down to the basement. One of my favorite edits in this episode, one of my favorite edits period in like all of editing, is when they show a character talking,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of linger on a reaction shot from them,
mm-hmm.
and they loop dialogue in over the top of it,
mm.
for the same character's dialogue. Like,
yeah,
it's almost like a late cut,
yeah,
for the video and an early cut for the audio.
But
I really like that.
Especially for phone conversations, it works well because it's a way to densely layer information.
Right.
Like, while the other person is talking, you can get their reaction,
mm-hmm.
but you can't hear anything, so lay the dialogue that led up to that or immediately afterwards on it. It's like a way to, like,
yeah,
essentially double the information bandwidth.
And it feels good in this kind of montage style thing.
Yeah, it's a good way to really tighten things up.
And I don't know if it was Kelly Dixon who edited this one or the other editor.
I think it was Kelly Dixon.
Okay.
Because she was taught. Yes, I know it was because she was saying that when they did this montage on the Insider podcast, that the director originally was going to do no audio. and just either loop in some dialogue and just covered a whole thing with music. And like when Kelly saw that in the notes for the shooting script, she calls him and is like, I hope I'm not too late, but please, please put in some dialogues because I love to be able to work with that stuff. And it's going to be so much easier than if we try to loop it in later. And they were able to catch that. And then,
He wasn't even going to record audio for
it? No, there was no dialogue written for it. They were going to do that later. Oh, so he had to sit, writer had to then go back and write. I forget what they call it. But there's like a particular, you know, when you're just writing a bunch of nonsense, short, witty, interesting stuff. Mm. It's like punch dialogue or something. I forget the exact term of art. But they did that and filmed it, and everybody was happy.
Yeah. So we go to Mike in the booth. He's talking to Stacy, who's staying in a hotel now. And Stacy asks when he's coming by. He says, it'll be a while because I look like shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's implied that he told her he was in a car wreck.
Sure.
And then as he hangs up the phone, Jimmy and Aaron drive into the lot, and Jimmy makes a Rocky joke about Mike's eye.
And a Fight Club joke, just pop culture everywhere.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, when he's humming the Rocky theme as they pull away, it's hilarious. Uh-huh.
Good stuff. Inside the courthouse, Jimmy tries to bribe the woman who's assigning the hearing dates, who we are familiar with. It's kind of where Jimmy got his start.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron refuses to let him bribe her, and they get a hearing date a month out.
I asked Doug. He sent in his weekly installment of Law Talk, and I shot something back. I'm like, is this really a crime? Is it frowned upon? Like, what's the deal? Because like in every professional circle I've ever seen, you know, $25 and below is kind of like, you know, that's not a bribe. That's not even considered a gift that you have to like document or anything. It's just and God knows salesmen, like, you know, that's how they close deals. They take you out to lunch and they like, oh, I know you like such and such. And so I thought that like, unless this is supposed to be $100 plus Beanie Baby, which I don't think that's a thing anymore, that this is just kind of like, like you said, you grease the wheels to get the result for your client. And it's like, I didn't even know it would arise to unethical behavior. Doug's opinion was that it would be a breach of ethics. It wouldn't be a crime, but it would be a breach of ethics.
Could potentially get you disbarred.
I mean, I don't know if it would be a pattern or but I mean, because when I have had dealings with defense attorneys in the past, like they're always quick to say, oh, I know so-and-so prosecutor and so judge, and I've golfed with them. And like they're implying this... Right. You know, like, you're supposed to have this thing where everybody's treated the same, and everybody's, but that can't be the case. Like, you got to preference or treat people you know versus not, and the ones you're friends with versus the ones you're not. And
is paying compliments against ethics? Like,
I mean, who knows?
If he were to flatter his way into a better hearing date, like, is that the same thing?
Yeah. Or if he just knows that you like a particular type of art and he read in the paper that there's that style of art coming to town and you might not read. I mean... I don't know.
It's tough. It's muddy waters there.
Yeah. But I thought the in-universe, we're supposed to understand that Aaron is being a particularly large pain in the ass.
And maybe that Jimmy, you know, this is Jimmy. He just doesn't play by the rules.
But also the clerk, I don't, like, I feel like he's right that this is how you do, if you're a public defender, this is how you roll to survive. And it's kind of the expected, it's the you know, coin of the realm. Whereas she, who's probably never done anything like this, you know, this is kind of the ivory tower versus gritty public defender kind of thing.
Yeah, I also wonder why he's so eager to get this hearing date. Because I would understand it. If you're a public defender and you're trying to grind out cases, you want to fit as many in as you can in rapid succession, right?
I would imagine.
But when you're working for Davis and Maine, what do you give a fuck if it's a month from now or next Thursday?
Yeah, time is, you know, I don't know. I didn't understand why they were here. Like, I didn't really understand what... I know they're filing a brief for... They're
trying to get a hearing, a summary judgment hearing with a judge.
Which there's some information in Law Talk if people want to stay to the end of the podcast to hear it. But yeah, I thought it was very unclear about exactly what the hell is going on here.
Huh. Okay.
This is the legal equivalent of recalibrating the dilithium crystals. You know? Like, who the fuck knows what that is, but it's an excuse to get data in Geordi and the engineering set and talking about something.
And probably a malfunction. That
Data
will...
can talk about his feelings about getting, you know, trying his boner subroutine, and Geordi can give him bad advice. That's what this scene was.
Okay. Then we get Jimmy stopping off in the bathroom, and he sees this public defender, or
this is
or mate.
No, no, no. He's maybe the prosecutor.
Okay,
this is the Petty with the Prior guy from last season.
It used to be his nemesis,
Petty with the Prior.
Last season, the guy's super jealous of Jimmy's new job, and Jimmy starts to kind of see his old life in a new light. I think he looks at this guy and goes, "Was I that? Am I still that?
You got like, that? I got it." Like, this is supposed to be a reminder of like how good he's got it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But now that he's got it and he hates it, it's like just serves to further his isolation.
That's why I say he's looking at his old life in a new light. Like, he probably doesn't want to go back to that. He knows he's got something much, much
that's
better
true.
Now, and maybe he's starting to recognize that a little bit.
Yeah, like the stakes, it raises the stakes because, you know, the perks he's got are nice.
And between, you know, seeing this schlub still doing the public defender type stuff and Kim slapping him down, it feels like maybe he's going, I wonder if I could do this.
Yeah.
I wonder if I should do this.
But then, yeah, when you hear the guys like, oh, yeah, that's vomit. Sure. Yeah. It's the second time I've been puked on today. Just scum. And, you know.
Could be one of two.
That's the guy he's trying to lock up. Those are the guys Jimmy's trying to get out. So.
Yeah.
I'm sure Jimmy's gotten a few double-breasted vomit stains, too.
I just wonder if this will be enough to keep Jimmy on the straight and narrow for, like, another episode.
I was going
to
say, not a full season.
No, hell no.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny to see the kind of ping pong with his soul going back and forth.
And his own internal struggle with it.
Sure.
Yeah. So the montage of Kim trying to drum up clients again. It's set to a Spanish version of My Way. I don't know who
did
this.
I love it. I could tell you here because I kazad it.
Shazammed it.
The
download.
No, then I kazad it. Yeah.
Okay.
I went back to 2003 and kazad that shit.
Pirated from LimeWire or some shit.
This says it's from a band called the Gypsy Kings. But
The Gypsy Kings, they do. I think they do the Hotel California cover as well.
Okay.
That's in Big Lebowski.
Okay, because a lot of people have covered this in Spanish. There's a bunch of French covers of My Way. Because, you know, My Way is a classic great song.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I thought this particular rendition with this particular montage was the best.
It's great.
And the only reason they got away with the double Kimtage is because the first one was just the facts. This one they could afford to be a lot more looser and conceptual with. And I thought
because you
great.
Already know what she's doing. You just need to see it happening over a long period of time.
Yes, to just get you, what a grind in the salt mines this is.
And I felt like you said, that song was perfect. And if they had used the English version, I think it would have been a little too on the nose.
It'd been distracting.
Right. Because here you're thinking, oh, I recognize that tune.
Yeah.
Oh, that's My Way. Ah, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. Whereas Frank Sinatra crooning would have been a little much.
Probably harder to get the licensing rights to, too.
Yes, more expensive. Anything else you want to say about that montage?
Nope, but except for the payoff scene.
Right, she's not having much luck. She finally gets a call back from an interested client. Celebrates her victory in the parking garage.
She is so cute. This little victory jig she does is awesome, and it's correspondingly awesome to how devastating it is when this doesn't work. Because they've showed how much, like, this woman has, for maybe weeks.
They imply a lot of time passing.
No life. Mm-hmm. Maybe not even, how many hours of sleep is she getting a night?
It doesn't look like much. They put some makeup on her to make her look tired.
And Kim's not the type that I think would enjoy cold calling. Uh-huh. Like, I hate, I've had to do it a couple times in my life, and it's the worst.
Yeah.
It is the worst. And I feel like she's the kind of personality that doesn't come easy. So, like, all these rejections are costing her psychically as well as just the frustration.
Yeah.
So, man, it really is a gut punch when Howard doesn't take her out of the doghouse after this.
Yeah, so let's talk about that scene.
Yep.
Time lapse on ABQ to Howard and Kim greeting the new clients at HHM. Meeting goes well. Kim assumes that she's out of the doghouse as they stand kind of waving goodbye to him. But Howard assigns the case to someone else, and he states that she has plenty of work to do.
Just the way he does it, because she's like, I'll get a team together and just assume, like, look what I've done. I've drug a $250,000 to you. And I wasn't clear if that's annual, if that was monthly. It's a retainer is a definite bonus.
Yeah.
But the way he's like, I'll put Francis on it. You've got enough on your plate with Doc Review. And
then walks off.
Her face, like, she's near tears.
And he... Yeah, everything about that performance is perfect from both sides. I think the guy playing Howard nails this scene. Ray Seahorn nails this scene. The way that he turns, and as he says, "I'll put Francis on it. You've got enough to do in the doc review." He looks right at her,
and that's the first time the entire time, because he's steadfastly avoided her gaze for everything up to here.
Yeah, it's devastating. It was devastating to me as a viewer. I can't imagine what Kim was feeling.
When they go in the long shot where you see the HH and M flag flying and she's just there and her body language is just, oh.
Yep. Then Howard goes over to Chuck's house, takes this new client over to him and says, "Hey, Kim brought him in." Chuck asks if she's out of the doghouse. Howard says, "Well, we'll see." In a way that tells me she's not quite out yet.
What is your interpretation of the scene? And because I feel like it's going to be the standard one, and then I'm going to tell you my crazy pondering.
My interpretation of the scene is that Chuck has less to do with Kim. I think Cliff and Howard are very similar animals in the way they think about branding, and that the commercial and Kim's betrayal of not telling them about it was a big slight to him.
Ah, you fool.
Because it messed up their branding.
You've fallen right into Chuck's trap.
I'm coming around on Chuck a little bit. And it's not like I think he's not at fault here at all. Mm-hmm. I think he is in some ways. It's more complicated than that. And now I think Howard has some skin in the game with the branding.
All right, so here's my interpretation.
Okay.
Early on in the season, we saw where Howard was explaining to Chuck how he didn't stand in Jimmy's way. And you could tell that Chuck was not saying, he was saying, "Oh yeah, no, you shouldn't have." But you could tell that that was not the answer he wanted to get from Howard.
Uh-huh.
And there's another scene where they're talking about how to deal with a certain situation. And Howard said something. You could tell that the eyebrows he raised and the sounds he made it seem like this was too much of a light touch. Here, he says, "I assume she's out of the doghouse," in almost exactly the same way that he was discussing getting in Jimmy's way. And Howard kind of makes a grimace and says, "We'll see." And Chuck makes this kind of, "Huh," like approving, like, "Oh, you're actually cracking the whip on people." I feel like that all of this stuff is, again, Howard trying to triangulate what Chuck wants and meet that without any kind, just the same way he does the last minute gaze down the conference room to see if everything's perfect for him. Mm-hmm. That he is trying to anticipate what Chuck wants, and he's finally dialed in and on the same page as Chuck. That's my interpretation.
Okay.
Again, I could be crazy, but that's what I think they're putting down.
I think they're... Maybe you could be right. I don't want to say you're not right on this, because I could see that. The other direction is, I feel like they're trying to indicate to us that Howard also has... Because what is Howard's place in this?
Like, well, that's the other... My other support was...
Is Howard just there to cater to the whims of Chuck? Or is Howard a character in his own right? And I don't feel like they would write a character who's just there to service another.
I think that that's kind of the power dynamic, though.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, so that is certainly in
the
there.
The other thing is, Chuck at the end, when he gets done talking to Kim, says, "I'll talk to Howard and see what we can do." Mm-hmm. Implying that he could put the kibosh on his punishment anytime he wants. If he was disapproving of the way Howard handled the Kim case, he wouldn't go, "Huh." He would go, "I don't know, Howard. She's a fourth law to just drug in $250,000. What the fuck?" I feel like that it's definitely he is... keeping his hands clean, but definitely approving of the way Howard is handling this, and Howard knows it. And Howard knows that he hasn't approved of the way he's handled these situations, and it's blown up in his face, and now he's in full-time,
so
full-on
you're saying,
appeasing Chuck
you're not
mode.
Saying that Chuck has anything to do with the punishment of Kim. You're just saying that Howard is punishing Kim because he thinks that's what Chuck wants.
And it is what Chuck wants. I'm not saying Chuck said to do this. I'm saying that he understood.
I don't know that Chuck wants to punish Kim. I don't think Chuck wants to punish Kim at all. I think he wants to punish Jimmy. He wants to keep Jimmy out of the law, but Kim as collateral damage is not pleasing.
Sure.
Him.
Yeah. No. I'm not saying that it takes pleasure in Kim getting destroyed like this. I'm just saying that it is. He knows it's a tool to use against Jimmy, and he's happy that Howard put the screws to her, and this lets him now go and sidle up to Kim and be the good cop and say, you really need to have nothing to do with my brother, and get her away from Jimmy, which protects her, which he wants to do, and also puts pressure on Jimmy to get on the straight and narrow. I essentially think that Chuck is playing emotional chess while Jimmy and company are playing emotional checkers.
Sure, yeah.
He is a manipulator, just like a very skilled manipulator.
Okay, so is Jimmy.
Yep.
So it's an interesting game.
And I like the contrast in their styles.
Right.
Jimmy's very overt. Chuck is so soft touch, you're not even sure he's got his hands on you. And it could all be in my head.
Well, he kind of rules through intimidation, whereas Jimmy rules through likability and charisma, right?
Yeah.
Chuck gives you the stern look, saying, mm-hmm. you better do what I want, without actually saying it, mm-hmm. whereas Jimmy makes you think he's your best friend, and therefore you want to do the things he's asking. I imagine this conversation will come up a few more times before all is said and done with Chuck and Jimmy.
And I got to think that's something in that writer's room. Like, yeah. We want to really make people guessing, because we don't want to, like, pro Chuck, pro Jimmy. And if we ever do an episode with that, then the next episode we're going to soften it and just keep on peeling these layers until we see what we end up with.
Yeah, and I think that works on a lot of levels, makes it more complex than most shows.
Yeah.
And encourages discussion, which is good.
Yep.
For us as podcasters. Mm-hmm. So also in the scene, Chuck understands that this is a big case. It's potentially years of work for HHM. Mm-hmm. So Kim has done a good thing.
Yep.
Then we go to Chuck having the office shut down for the night so he can go in and work. He runs into Kim and invites her to share a cup of coffee.
In the most patronizing, insulting way possible.
Right. Make me coffee.
Yes.
Oh, you want a cup too, I guess?
Yeah.
I don't know. I almost felt some kind of weird kinship here. Like, coming right off that conversation with Chuck where she's hustling mm-hmm. to bring in this big mm-hmm. client, mm-hmm. I felt like he was kind of leveling with her as an equal a bit here.
If he was loving an equal, then he wouldn't ask. He wouldn't treat her like... treated her like a secretary. You're supposed to understand that.
He treated her like a secretary because he literally can't make this coffee.
Okay.
He's not asking her to make the coffee because he doesn't want to do it and he thinks she's inferior and should do it. He can't do it.
I get it, but that is still treating her like a secretary. Let's say that he had a medical condition where he couldn't wipe his ass, and he went in without his live-in nurse to the office and pooped his pants, and she just happened to... And he's like, hey, could you wipe my ass? I can't quite get to it. That your logic still applies, but it's still a demeaning thing to do, especially to a professional. You know, she's a fourth year, and you're treating her like a lawyer, even if he's got a good reason to do it.
You wouldn't make a cup of coffee for a friend? You wouldn't pour a friend a drink?
If I offered to make that friend a cup of coffee, hey, I see you're in, you probably can't work
you
the
machine.
You
wouldn't fulfill a request from a friend to make a cup of coffee? Come on, man.
I'm not saying that he's not her friend, he's her boss. I'm just saying right. that, like, you're supposed to understand that he's being patronizing. And in fact, the, make it two seemed like him realizing what an asshole he is. And adding on the, make yourself too, just so to kind of cover what it's...
I didn't get that.
Really?
I didn't get that vibe. I got it more of like, she turns down drinking coffee with him for a second, right? She's mm-hmm. like, it's not implied that she's going to drink it with him, mm-hmm. just that she's going to make some for both of them.
Okay.
She says, no, I'm not, I don't want to drink coffee. And then he says, well, could you make me some? And then he invites her. I felt the invite was fairly genuine. I didn't think it was like an, no, I should be nice here. I guess you can come drink with me if you want. It felt like, let's talk.
Hmm.
That's what it felt like to me, especially off the back of this last scene.
Yeah, and I definitely think that I think he backed off because this is all a surprise. He didn't expect her to be here.
Right.
So, like, he's thinking, oh, yeah, you know, I kind of want to talk to her, and he backs it. But no, I guess.
He does back into it in a slightly strange way, but. I didn't read.
Well,
anything.
I mean, a lot of this is, I feel like that broadly, I'm anti-Chuck and you're pro-Chuck in this episode. So
sure.
we are viewing it through those lenses and coming to two different conclusions.
That's true. So they share a cup of coffee. Kim asks if she has a future at HHM. Chuck starts to talk about how Jimmy always leaves people holding the bag, just like he did here to her, and how he believes that he stole $14,000 from their father's corner store, causing it to go out of business. maybe causing the father's death. I don't know if that's implied, but
maybe Jimmy killed him.
It's a
for the insurance money.
Right. So he ends by promising to talk with Howard about her position and complimenting Kim on the work she's done with Mesa Verde.
Uh-huh.
Verde. God, I can't say it. Which is the new client, if you hadn't picked that up.
So the two big questions are, is this story true? And does Kim think it's true?
Kim has a look on her face that says, this information is interesting.
I feel like that she is trying, you can see her, and in fact, she even mentioned on the Insider cast that she was deliberately trying to convey this into her performance, that
right.
I'm not sure, like, some of this rings a bell, like, maybe I've heard of the Family Store, but then, oh, this doesn't sound like Jimmy versus, well, maybe this does sound...
Like the stuff he's been up to lately, maybe it does.
Like,
yeah.
It's a mental Plinko machine, and the uh-huh. these little facts are going into, like, okay, maybe this is an embellishment. The big question is...
I think
is,
that's the easier of the two questions to answer.
Okay.
The other one that you asked, is the story true? That's a tough question. Okay, maybe not is the actual fact of the story true, like $14,000 was missing.
Uh-huh.
Is it true that Jimmy was the one who stole it? Is it true that Chuck has the right perspective on this?
That's the thing. Like, even if it's true, is it, or it, whether it's true or false, is it true in like the Obi-Wan Kenobi sense of the word?
Right.
Like, from his point of view, he stole it, or from like maybe his dad had an embarrassing like medical condition or a gambling problem that he was hiding this whole time.
Or hey, it'd be a shame. You got a nice store here. It'd be a real shame.
There's protection money that he knew that Chuck wouldn't be down with, and Chuck doesn't even know this because
it is Cicero after all.
Right. Right.
So like,
or it could be that there was some other dude that was stealing this whole time.
Right. And now.
Or, like, it wouldn't surprise me if you find out that Chuck himself is the person who stole this and has recontextualized in his own mind that it's Jimmy to live with it.
You're really down on Chuck.
No, I'm saying that this guy's got a lot of fucking pathology in his mind. And
I'm going to go with you because I'm about to speculate real crazy, too.
Because to dismiss, like, this is a guy who has a complete psychosomatic syndrome.
Yeah.
This is all in his head. He's had some kind of psychotic break through some kind of trauma. So, like, I don't think there's anything that you can take off the table for why this has happened, you know?
You're absolutely right. It's very complicated. And I think we're supposed to be asking those questions at this point.
Which, by the way, makes me hate Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, because there's no fucking way they intended to do anything more than make a colorful quirk on this character by making him with this, you know, allergic to electricity routine.
But then they've spun it out.
But then they've spun it, and they sat in a writing room, and they've analyzed it until they've got on that. I'm like, fuck you guys.
Right.
Fuck you guys.
That's brilliant writing, though.
It's
brilliant
crazy
writing.
Good. It's crazy good. And I know it's not just them. It's the whole team. But still, all those guys and girls.
New writer on this on this episode. It's a guy who wrote on Bloodline before. Mm-hmm. Kind of quit Bloodline to come over to Better Call Saul.
That was the guy from. So he wrote both of these episodes because he did the last one too.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless maybe you're blending the two insiders.
Maybe it's possible. I actually didn't look at which one I clicked, so maybe I was listening to one from last episode. Plus, they're recording them out of order.
Yeah.
Which also confuses me. I don't
know.
But yeah, new writer on one of those episodes. Mm-hmm. But I honestly can't tell. I think the writing has been solid across the board.
So what's your crazy theory?
This is dead man's brew here. This is some lunacy of the highest order.
All right.
We start off this episode with Rebecca, right? Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem to have a lot to do with the events of this episode.
Uh-huh.
I mean, thematically, obviously, pitting Chuck against Jimmy in a certain way, showing how Chuck feels about this relationship. That's valuable, but it's something that we kind of already knew, right?
And also establishing nakedly the jealousy that we thought has been in the relationship.
Right, right. Uh-huh. We've felt that before. Is there any chance... Let's go down this road of Chuck is
murdered Rebecca.
No. Oh. Chuck is a really bad guy.
And his father.
Chuck is a just shit bag, because I know that's where you want to go. Is there any chance that something Jimmy did in the past drove away Rebecca? And that now, part of persecuting Kim, if you think that Chuck's behind it, is a little bit of payback for that. because he understands the relationship that it's Chuck possible. And Kim have.
I mean, we've Jimmy seen that. That's the thing. Like, I'm not totally anti-Chuck because the thing that you got to go back to is that Chuck is right about a lot of things. I've seen him.
That's true. Yeah.
Almost destroy Kim's career.
Yeah.
And her tell her, and it's not like he bumbled into it.
About it.
And the whole time she's saying, this is what you're doing, this is what's going to happen if you don't stop.
Yeah.
And also it's jeopardizing our friendship and our relationship, and Jimmy does it anyway.
Yep.
So I totally believe that he would do that to his big brother, to his dad, to everybody in his path.
Without even kind of thinking about it.
And in fact, to adopt mental practices to isolate himself, to be like, it's not my fault, it's always some other person's fault.
Right.
Super annoying people to have in your life. So, yes, like that's, I'm not totally anti-Chuck.
I think it's off in the weeds. I think it's crazy talk to mm-hmm. say that, like, he drove Rebecca away from Chuck somehow, but I'm throwing it out there.
Yeah. No, I feel like the Chuck, I don't know, Chuck, there was some interesting psychological analysis of him in the feedback. Okay. But I feel like that Chuck is starting to do the wrong things, but for the right reasons, which is, he's a very, I think they're establishing him a mirror,
we talked about
being a mirror
time.
Image
yeah.
of Jimmy.
We talked about like the ends justifying the means yes. and how each of the brothers feels about that.
Yes.
I think that still applies, certainly, in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to apply for a while, until this thing is resolved one way or another.
Yep.
Until Jimmy's out of the law, or Chuck is dead.
Yeah, no.
It's going to be a problem.
It's amazing that they've still got this thing going between the two brothers without really rolling anything back.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like they've done that really skillfully.
Yeah, I mean, it's been almost an entire season now that they've kept this thing going.
Sure.
But it's a complex thing, so it warrants that time. We go back to Mike sitting in a diner. When a man in a familiar hat does something unfamiliar, he walks in mm-hmm. to apologize for Tuco's temper and asks Mike to tell the police that the gun was his, not Tuco's, in exchange for $5,000. This scene plays really heavily on our Breaking Bad knowledge.
Sure.
I thought, yes, there's like a small mention of Tuco being connected to the cartel last episode
mm-hmm.
that serves to kind of patch it, but I feel like this scene doesn't work nearly as well unless you know who this man is.
We keep saying that, but I think obviously saying that this guy's family is cartel is enough that a reasonable person would know what this means. Now, they're
right,
not going to know the full...
Right, but they don't get the nuance. They don't get...
Sure, sure. But that's kind of like if you're a virgin breaking, you know, non-Breaking Bad viewer watching this, it's almost all about the nuance. I think you're going to get the text and even the subtext,
you
but
do. Yeah.
The nuance... I thought it was funny. Mike B wrote in and said, "You know, I didn't recognize that character in the diner. It just didn't ring. He just didn't ring a bell."
Jesus, shame on you.
So, man,
this is like a bad lawyer joke.
This is so great. And the greatest thing is Mike's face at the end. Do you know what that's the face of?
A man who just found himself boxed in.
That's the face of a man who took a half measure. And he fucking knows it. Because now he's got an even worse problem to deal with. How does he get out of this?
Okay. Can I just say I think it's maybe good that he took a half measure here?
Well, I'm not...
I think he'd be in more trouble if he didn't.
Well, I mean, how would they have found... I mean, only if they had found out that it was him.
Right. I guess he could have... They may never have found out.
Right.
If he did.
I mean, this
is
like...
his sniper plan.
So it's because... So, my prediction is that Mike is going to kill Nacho. Or he's going to give up Nacho.
Right, so he's got multiple problems here. Okay. Let me start off.
Yeah, let's talk about the predicament.
Yes, let's start with the implication here, right? Because this is an offer he can't refuse. This is the classic,
yes.
Do this thing or you're in serious trouble.
Yep.
Probably going to be dead.
It's a carrot and stick.
There's a Reddit user, Kaz Trader.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Z.
That's why I never
read
Reddit usernames.
This was such a good point, though, and it cut through the bullshit that's usually in a subreddit so precisely that I wanted to call him out. He points out that the $5,000 is the amount of money that Stacy was talking about Matt having taken from those dirty cops.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the implication here that not only are we saying, hey, I'm a tough guy and I'm going to hurt you if you don't do this,
mm-hmm.
but... I know about your past. You're an ex-cop. I also know about this.
No fucking way.
I think it's there.
I think this.
I think it's subtle, but I think it's there.
I wouldn't put it past T.O. On the other hand, which I thought is funny because Kelly Dixon calls him Uncle T.O.
T.O.
Yep.
Uncle.
Hector Salamanca.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. That's definitely. I couldn't put it past it, but I do think this is more a thematic thing. This is like the 30 pieces of silver. Okay. In the Bible, that comes up in a bunch of different circumstances. This 5,000.
In that case, I'm asking for like 120 pieces of silver. Like
it's more like Mike understands. Like, oh shit, this is a moral problem I got. Not that I know about your dirty past, because if they thought that he was doing this to fuck with Tuco, I don't think there would be any kind of negotiation. They would just kill Mike.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. I mean, he's a hired gun, and the real culprit here is Nacho. Like that's the thing. That's okay, the thing. So like, the implication is he now has a problem. He's stuck between a rock and a hard place.
He can't just give the $25,000 back to Nacho and be like, even Steven.
Because Nacho doesn't get what he wants.
What kind of problems can Nacho cause him if he takes the $5,000 and just... Because he's still going away for a couple of years.
Right, but much less than if he had the gun charge.
So that's something that gives Nacho time to get his affairs in order and get the hell out of Dodge.
Mm-hmm.
And what can Nacho do to Mike? Can Nacho pop Mike? You know, with like scot free. I don't know. It seems to me that the resolution, because there's a couple exciting things like, are we going to see the cousins? Are we going to see Gus this early? Like, one play he could make is Gus finds out about this and offers to broker the deal in exchange for Mike's services.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen him do that before. We've seen him do the, like, I need this man. He's my associate.
Yeah, he might be able to protect Mike from ramifications.
Yes.
But I
feel like I feel like this doesn't end good for Nacho. Because maybe right. Mike doesn't do it, but that's something that Gus is going to take care of him, and Mike is going to understand that, you know, him hesitating to pull the trigger, this half measure, had a thug with a heart of gold get killed, and the real terrible, like, you know, cartel people are triumphant.
And this is really brilliant, too, because of the way it pulls Mike into this drug game. I mean,
sure.
He's getting deeper than he wants to be, but he's doing it out of the love for his daughter and granddaughter.
And you can say that he has distaste for this cartel situation.
Stepdaughter? No.
No, it's his granddaughter.
Daughter-in-law
and granddaughter.
Right. I was trying to think of the term.
You can tell he has this real disdain for this cartel situation. Like, you know, like in his mind, this is above the common crook. These guys are real scumbags.
Doesn't want to work with them, yeah.
And you can see how Gus can make a play for, like, I don't let, you know, like, this is a long-term plan of me taking down the cartel and have a responsible businessman be over this trade. I can see that appealing to him in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. And he's kind of got to do it. I mean, like I said, it's an offer he can't refuse.
Now, structurally, I'm not sure where that leaves the show going to next season if they get Gus involved already, because, you know, kind of Mike and Saul, or Mike and Jimmy, rather, are more or less peers. As soon as Mike takes which we know Jimmy doesn't know about, as soon as Mike takes this job with Gus and who all that is, that feels like it's going to erect a pretty big wall. Like, you know, Mike might render him professional services for a fee, but there's not going to be this palsy-wowsy and deep moral philosophizing. I don't know. Or maybe they'll have a way to deal with that.
Yeah. And Mike seems to be the one guy who's immune to Jimmy's charms.
Yeah.
So I don't think he can charm his way back in.
Or maybe Mike solves this other problem with Nacho by himself, but that leaves him in a position where he needs Gus later on. Because obviously we're at the end of this arc, Mike will end up working for Gus.
Well, I mean, this is like... It's also blackmail in a way, right? Like, once you do something for the cartel, why are they going to stop asking you to do things for them?
Exactly.
Now they know what you're capable of. They know what you can do for them.
Yep.
They're going to come calling again. And I think maybe that's how he gets drugged back in. These people are too evil, too powerful for him to resist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he can resist Jimmy or Nacho even.
Yeah.
I mean, this scene is brilliant in how it just sets up the sheer problem, the sheer terror of the problem that Mike has now.
I do think he thinks he should have shot Taco. Should have shot Taco. Should have shot Taco and Nacho. right in his Tuco, and been done with it.
And eaten a burrito.
Yep.
Game over. All right, that's it for the episode. I don't have anything else to talk about.
Okay, here is a treat. Before we get the feedback, we talked yesterday to Max Arciniega, who plays Crazy 8 / Domingo on Breaking Bad and also the last episode of Better Call Saul. Really interesting guy, incredibly nice guy, very generous with his time. You know, we got to meet him in person at the Breaking Bad Fan Fest, which is how we kind of got this relationship, and had a really nice conversation with him, with some behind-the-scenes detail and what's going on with him. And without further ado, here it is. But how's it going?
Good. A little tired, but good. I had a long night of poker yesterday, actually with Aaron Paul.
No way. Huh.
Yeah, we play poker very often when he's in town, and so it's now, been going on for years, man.
You guys are, does that mean you're roughly evenly matched, or is one of you the mark?
Man, honestly, like, we go back and forth. Honestly, he takes some big pots, and I've taken some big pots. He usually hosts them at his place,
uh-huh.
And so we get around maybe like sometimes the bigger games are like two tables. We'll have like maybe about a total of 16 people.
Wow.
We'll do like a $100 or $200 buy-in. And then, you know, with the rebuys and everything, the pot adds up.
Oh, does he try and push you around with the big stack? Is that what it is? Aaron Paul big-timing people on the poker table?
If he gets the big stack, he does. He's a good player, though, man. He really is. He usually gets to the final table. Yesterday, he got out early. But, you know, I made it to the final four. I went out on the bubble, but...
It sucks.
Especially when you're so close and like it's 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're just like, I cannot lose right now, man.
Does he got the really good poker face?
Yes, he does, man.
Does he have full sunglasses and hat, or is he just
no sunglasses and hat?
Wow.
After all this time, he's still very hard to read, man. Very, very hard to read.
No one expects the baby face Jesse to be pulling the perfect poker face.
The baby face assassin.
Although you guys both, you give each other a run for the money in the baby face department. One of a couple of our listeners asked if you had any skincare tips because your genes must be amazing. Because you are one of the few that are plausibly playing a younger version of yourself from Breaking Bad. Like Jonathan Banks, I don't think can say that. Bob Odenkirk, I don't think can say that, but you, I don't feel like you've aged in 10 years.
You know what's funny, man, is when Melissa Bernstein, who's one of the producers on the show, called my manager, she said the same thing. She goes, what's funny is, like, he's the only one that hasn't really aged. And they were laughing. You know what? It's honestly my dad's genes, man. My dad was always, like, he still, to this day, he's about, like, 60, 63 or 64, and just has never, ever, ever... he's always just looked so much younger, and I have an older brother and a younger sister. And my younger sister, I mean, she looks like she could still be a teenager. Mm-hmm. And my brother, who's 40, still looks like he's in his early 30s easily. That and, you know, Hollywood, you know, surgery. No, I'm just kidding.
I thought you were going to say clean living. You know?
I was saying clean living. No, he's sleeping in one of the hyperbaric chambers. And
you know what's funny though? I do. I am pretty. I do. Eat very well. I exercise a lot, and I think, you know, I don't smoke. I don't drink.
I remember that about you. You were one of the few ones not drinking at the
Gardunios,
Fan Fest.
Yeah.
So maybe that contributes an extra year for me or something.
Yeah.
You're also just like a super nice guy. It's one thing that struck me about, like, you've got this particular type of really positive energy. Is that something that you kind of like is innate, or is it, you know, you're an actor. Is that something you kind of like work at, or?
Oh man. Thank you, man. I mean, honestly, I just had good parents, man. I really, really did. I've always respected my parents, and they just, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, they weren't very, like they weren't the type that they were not strong parents where it's like, where they were aggressive or they just led by example, and I just kind of like, you know, I've always had a lot of respect for my mom and my sisters and my dad too. He's just a very, very, I have more of my mom's personality. My dad's super, super, just a super sweet guy. I've never, ever, ever heard him talk about anyone in a negative way. Mm-hmm. And it's a trait that I always tell him too. I remind him, I'm like, I said, you know, I said, you have this thing about you, man, where it's just like, you just always, you know, if someone's in a group talking about something, then they'll ask his opinion and he'll be like, ah, yeah, you know, everybody, you know, everybody's different, you know, have comments like that, you know, okay. But he's always, and that kind of always stuck to me, man. And I think that, you know, just being respectful to people, and even when they're not as respectful to you, just, I think that if you always take that light, it's always going to be a better resolution then.
Well, you need to sit him down across the table from Aaron Paul at the poker table and see if he changes his tune. See how he likes it.
So the one question that I thought was really astute that we had from one of the listeners is, because you're there kind of from the beginning of Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. Literally, yeah. Like the pilot, and which is also kind of like, that was like Vince Gilligan and that whole production, like that was kind of their first go at like a, you know, being a showrunner at this big drama. And now you're here in season two of Better Call Saul. Were there any big changes as far as like, you know, is this like a now well-oiled machine, where all the like sharp edges sanded off? Was it like more relaxed, confident? Was there any change between the vibe on set and with the production, or was it pretty much the same?
You know what's crazy is you would think so, and to be honest with you, when we did the pilot and then when I worked on the two episodes after that, I think the reason that it went very well was because there was an absolute calmness on Vince's end. Like, he's just been doing it for years, and just great communication. Adam Bernstein, who directed my episode here on Better Call Saul, directed me in the second and third episode of Breaking Bad.
Right.
So I got a chance to work with him again. And it was just super calmness. And the great thing is they have confidence in the people that they cast too. So there's they give you a lot of space to do what you do. And then, you know, there's little notes here and there, and there's communication about the role and stuff, but they just create that very, very, very comfortable space to just play and come up with stuff. And when I arrived the second time around, it was the exact same way. I saw Adam again. We were excited to work with each other. And he was just kind of like, yeah, he's like, you know, I loved what you did the first time around. Let's do it again. And it was just that calm. And it was like that during the pilot, and at least when I worked on it, there was always a sense of just, and everyone's nice though. Everyone's like just really, really, really nice. You almost feel suspect about it, right? Because like all these people can't be nice, man. Everybody, sooner or later, someone's gonna break, you know. But you know, Vince is genuinely that person that you see in the interviews. I mean, he's a super, super sweet guy, and you know, if you have questions, you know, they're there to answer them. But it's always been the same, just very, very calm, and it really suits the actors a lot.
That's what I think is interesting about Vince and Peter Gould is that, you know, so often in our society, the high achievers seem like they're just really intense. Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, you get the like asshole coaches that are like always screaming at the other players and like, oh, that's what it takes to succeed. But yet Vince does it with that laid back, you know, Southern gentleman style. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. He can get such a high quality product from, I guess, you just surround yourself with nice people. You don't have to be a jerk.
Yeah, and it's funny, man, because I kind of grew up that way, because I played sports since I was a kid, and uh-huh. I liked very much that coaching style, being super, super aggressive and, like, you know, screaming at your team and making sure that everyone's on point.
And that passion.
With a passion. And then when I started on the acting side, though, it was a complete opposite, because I remember working with directors that when it doesn't seem like they have control of the ship, that's usually when the rest of the actors and the rest of the crew and everyone else feel like, well, if he doesn't have control of the ship, it's just going to be unbalanced, you know? And I noticed with working with, there's been some directors that I've worked with that are very that way, you know, and they'll make certain comments that just don't sit well. So anytime you have an actor in an uncomfortable situation, it's just never going to go right. Mm. And I realized that the calmer the set, the calmer the director, the easier it is to give a better performance and to communicate with the rest of the team. And so it's pretty interesting. But everyone works different, though, you know? Some people like that.
Hmm. Speaking of communication, so you go into this thing, right? You get the phone call. You say, okay, we're bringing you back for Better Call Saul. And then I know you have a very, like, public presence on Twitter for the most part. What is it like trying to keep that information a secret for presumably at least weeks, right? Months?
Months, actually, yeah. It was months because I found out, I think in July of last year. And I didn't shoot till, I believe, October.
Okay.
And it didn't air till February.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It was terrible.
I saw like Reddit threads where people were like, Max Arciniega confirms that he's going to be on Better Call Saul and whatnot. And I always thought it was it's funny because you're like, oh, yeah, whatever. I wish.
Exactly, man. It's really, really, really tough because, you know, you want to tell your friends and you want to tell your family.
Sure.
But you have so much respect for them and what they're doing. So you just don't say anything. And people don't really want to know. Right? They
right.
really don't want to know. Because I was the same way when I was watching the other seasons of Breaking Bad. Aaron would always give me all the episodes ahead of time before they aired.
Mm.
And so after like the third season, I was just like, I kind of don't want to do this anymore. I kind of want to watch along with the fans because then I have no one to talk to about it.
Sure.
Uh-huh.
You know? And
it's like
it was the same thing with this. It was just kind of like, I mean, if I tell somebody, it's not going to be a cool surprise and, you know. Mm-hmm. But either way, I wasn't going to tell anyone because it would have killed me. So,
if Vince is nice, he's not that nice.
Yeah, exactly.
is there like, I'm curious how that works when you actually go to film the thing. Do they like chauffeur you around in windowless vans and like keep you sequestered in hotels, or how does that all work?
Well, they don't, but they kind of hope that you try to stay low key at the hotels for sure.
Right.
I remember when we were shooting and on a drive back, Michael Mondo, who plays Nacho, mm-hmm. Was talking to one of the producers in the van because it was we were all there, Tuco as well, Raymond Cruz. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, we wanted to go maybe have a dinner or something. And you could tell her face was just like, she's like, well, you know what? I could set something up where you guys could maybe have it inside the hotel.
Uh-huh.
And then immediately we knew, like, we were like, all right, we better not do it.
Sure.
You know, Albuquerque, it's a small town, you know, and all of a sudden you see three bad guys together. You're just like, something's fishy.
Yeah, and I imagine they probably know your face around there too. So
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's... so what was it, the scene that you had where you go back and, you know, your crazy aide had never in this original series met Tuco face to face that I recall. But what was it like? Cause I thought it was, you know, there's a kind of a black comedy to what Raymond Cruz is doing with Tuco, where he's just kind of mad dogging you and doing his lie detector. Mm-hmm. And I assume that during these takes, you're just staring at him. You know, the camera's on him and he's staring at you. It's like, what is that like? Did you guys crack up? Because I assume that Raymond Cruz is not that intense in real life. But what was it like to shoot that scene? And was it fun? Was it just like in and out? Or can you talk a little bit about the experience of the day?
Yeah. What's funny is that I'd never met him before. And we came in and we did a rehearsal as usual. And in the rehearsal, he was in it, man. Like, he was just in that space. So it was really, really, really awkward and uncomfortable.
So he's just Tuco when he's on set, huh?
Yeah, at that moment he was. Yeah. And he's a great actor, man. Raymond Cruz, by the way. I just finished working with him on another project. But that day, yeah, he was already in it. And I kind of didn't know how to approach the situation, which was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sat us down at the table and it was super, super uncomfortable and awkward. And I wouldn't look at him until they'd call action. And then I'd start and then he'd sit there and it was just like, you know, you could hear a pin drop.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept doing that. And between takes, we spoke very, very little. And it wasn't until I was done with the scene and I stuck around to see them shoot the second part of that we started chatting a little bit, and then the nice Raymond came out of him. But during the scene, yeah, it was super, super business, and it worked really well because I didn't know who he was, how he was going to act. And I remember as a fan watching the show and I'm like, damn, this guy's, I mean, this is it. He's an intimidating dude. And so I used that in a crazy way to kind of just allow myself to be it was really, like I said, it was like I didn't have to act. I was really just nervous and kind of intimidated to be there in front of them. And
yeah,
I think it worked out.
It's funny because the way you described the atmosphere on the set is kind of like how it came across on the film, because you're kind of like, oh, is this guy joking? Oh, no, he's not. Oh, this is kind of scary. Like, it's,
yeah.
It worked really.
Yeah, trying to look over at Nacho, who brought me there, to kind of be like, all right, is this, yeah, exactly. Is it a joke or what's going on here?
No, I don't know if you, because, like, I thought there was a lot of really great details about, like, your costuming, because they have you in, like, the Tampico Furniture Company polo, which is, like, that big story you tell Walt, which, you know, yeah. That's, I guess that's one thing I've always debated, like, how much were you being honest with Walt? And how much yeah. you're just, like, spinning the story. But this implies that there's a lot of truth to what you told Walt as far as your you know, kind of more nice boy beginnings.
Yeah, I think I did an interview with AMC, and they had asked that similar question about that backstory. And friends and, you know, people that watch the show would always ask me about what I thought about how much of that was true. And it's hard. It's sometimes hard to make choices just because, you know, the writers will pull the rug from under you.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
You assume that this is what it's supposed to be and it's not. And it keeps you on your toes, which is a great thing. I always like to leave a little door open just in case something happens. Because, you know, in television, you never know. You might come back or, you know, what have you. So I remember for the pilot, I was saying to myself, like, you know, it's going to be great to just play him for what he is on paper at this point. And if something were to happen, hopefully, you know, there'll be another element to him. And sure enough, you know, Vince wrote that third episode and it was just like, oh, my God, there's much, much more
yeah.
than we thought, which is what makes it exciting for me, you know, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, playing bad, you know, playing a villain versus, you know, a gangbanger are two different things for me all the time.
Sure.
You know, if we're doing like a East L.A., you know, Cholo versus, you know, someone who's just a villain, then it's a different approach. And so I was really, really excited to see all of that. In my head, I felt a lot of it to be true. I felt like, you know, there was this guy who had an opportunity or who had a dream of doing something good, and his dad pretty much shut that dream down. And there was really, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you, as a young man, you always want to impress your dad, per se. You want to make your dad proud. If he's the one that's saying that that's not going to happen, you ain't got a shot at it. It's kind of like, you know, crushes your dream and you take another route. And I think that in his case, he just made a bad decision.
Yeah.
And so when I saw this and I saw the Tampico furniture truck and all of that, I was like, yes, this is great, because this can be a great exploration to everything that was happening at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was super excited and also very excited to see him at that state in a much more vulnerable place where he's, you know, coming in to try to impress Nacho and Tuco to try to make a little side money, which then I said, it's also a feeling of like, wow, so that situation with his dad has happened already, where he's crushed his dream, where he's got to go out and try to make some side money or something. And who knows? I mean, it could be such a crazy backstory, you know? Who knows why he's trying to, you know, make this extra money.
Right. I was going to ask you, I know you can't comment on whether or not you'll be in the series again, but mm-hmm. do you, in your mind, is there kind of more story left to tell with Crazy 8? Because we have seen a couple different sides of him, you know? Is that all that there is to this man, even though we've seen a lot? Or do you think there's yeah. other places he could go?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think there's always so many stories for everyone, you know? I mm-hmm. think we only show as humans what we kind of want to present of ourselves, you know? And I think, yeah, there's so much to explore. I just don't know what it is and
yeah.
where it's going to go or anything. Because, like I said, you know, I watch and I look, you know, at, for instance, Saul Goodman, and then all of a sudden he's Jimmy McGill, and I'm just like, holy crap.
Yeah.
He's a completely different human being before he was Saul Goodman. And to explore that much and to see that much of him so far, you know, any character can have so much more. And so I'm looking forward to see what comes of that.
Well, that's certainly one of the premises of the show, is because, you know, it's like, oh, we'll see how Better Call Saul became who he was. But, you know, what mm-hmm. surprised me is, like, we also get to see how Mike kind of became who he was, and we're seeing even, like, Nacho. Like, there's a lot more going on with him and his relationship with Tuco. And so it wouldn't shock me to see that, because there's a lot of, like, you can think of some story hooks there. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you see... you see you in this scene and you're kind of like fresh faced and you still got the you know, driving around a furniture truck, and you know, this isn't the same guy who's training dogs to fight, and like it is like you got a lot more rougher around the edges in the Breaking Bad. So it's like that's a story right there, you know.
Exactly.
Like where
exactly
how, yeah
and that's the exciting part about it too.
Yeah,
you know. And it's funny because I see Tuchel in this, and I also see like something off balance about him too. You know, it's like in Breaking Bad, you know, he's like there, man, and he's a super aggressive. And it's when I saw him in the scene with Mike, there was something about him that was just like, you know, he was super tough and everything, but there was something to me that stood out. And maybe this is just me and my perspective of how I saw it, but you know, there was almost like a little bit of compassion for a moment, and then all of a sudden he got back into it. It was really, really interesting.
It
and
did.
Maybe that's just
yeah. It's like he's early on enough in the meth that it's like his brain's not totally gone. So like you could tell, last thing he wanted to do is beat up this old man.
Yeah.
He will beat up the old man, but he's trying to like, you know, sir, did you notice that you hit my car? Like, so is that the second part? Were you able to see that filming part?
Yeah, that's the part I'm talking about.
Did you get to see them actually having a scuffle outside too?
Yeah, the first part of it before lunch, yeah. But there was definitely a lot of that, yeah.
Is that as much fun to... Because, like, as a fan, I think it must be so much fun to watch a show that you love, like, to see both sides of it. Is it as much fun to watch that as I think it is? Or is it, like, you know, everything's so pulled apart and isolated that it's not as... It doesn't flow as much when you're actually there?
Well, it doesn't flow as much because you rarely get through it, like through the entire scene altogether, because they're going to cut at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But that was actually the beauty of that third episode in the basement with Walt, because they set the cameras and they let us go all the way through nonstop.
Mm.
And so that's exciting, man, for an actor, because it's almost like doing theater where you're just like, it allows you to stay in the scene without cutting. And but it's still very, very exciting. I mean, especially because I'd never met Mike, for instance. And it was great to sit down with him and just chat. And he's just so wise and so experienced and such a nice guy too. I mean, and then, well, watch him get his butt whooped. Wasn't fun, but, but it is exciting. I mean, because I'm a fan as well, you know, and I saw these guys, you know, in the series, and it's like to sit there and watch them work was super exciting. Super, super exciting.
There's another question one of our listeners had for you as an actor, which I mm-hmm. thought was an interesting question. It was, has there been a part in a TV show or like a movie that you're watching it and you're like, you know, this actor is doing an okay job, maybe he's doing an amazing job, but man, this is the part I was born to play. Is there any, like, if you had a dream role, is there anything that you'd like to slide Max or Cineegg into?
Whew, that's a good question. It's as weird as it's going to sound. It's tough to, I've never had anything very specific.
Mm-hmm.
There are projects that myself and my writing partner, we're working on a script now, where, like, for instance, one of them that stood out to me was the story of Cesar Chavez.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And they did a movie on him, and it was played by Michael Peña, who played the lead role. Characters like that stand out to me. You know, something iconic figures, but it's hard. You know, we have to find those iconic figures in the Hispanic community. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the hard part. You know, when I was growing up in Chicago, it was hard to, you know, look on TV and, you know, kind of see someone that, I remember the only person that stood out to me was actually Oscar De La Hoya.
Hmm. Okay.
Because here's this young guy from East LA, Mexican-American kid, who is on top of the world, you know?
Yeah.
And he was, you know, on the cover of magazines, and I'd read about him. I wanted to see his work ethic. I wanted to see what it was that he was doing that, you know, made him so great. But there weren't a lot of those. And that was the tough part. So it's kind of like hard to look up to a certain, like, I don't look at movies like, let's say, Good Will Hunting and say, I would love to be Matt Damon.
Sure.
I'm probably not going to be Matt Damon in that movie. But
how's your Boston accent?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. those are the movies that I look at that I love. Like, I'm, you know, that's one of the great movies. I look at The Shawshank Redemption, for instance, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, movies like that. So there's nothing specific per se, but I do enjoy stories about, you know, iconic figures. I love boxing too. Boxing movies are great. Maybe like a boxing one, but those are very hard to come by as well.
Oscar De La Hoya, man, that's pretty tasty because you even got the kind of physicality. Like, you don't even have to squint that hard and it's like, oh yeah, I can see that guy in that role.
yeah, something like that, man. Something like that. It's exciting, man. But yeah, you see what I'm saying. It's kind of one of those things of like trying to. A specific role, I wouldn't know, to be honest with you. But Cesar Chavez is one of them, you know. He was someone that I read a lot about growing up, and I thought, you know, he was, especially during the movements, he was, you know, walking right hand of Martin Luther King right around the same time. Mm-hmm. So stuff like that, yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, you mentioned that you're doing writing and have your own production company. I guess if you mm-hmm. if you have an ideal role for yourself, the sure way to get that on camera is to write it for you.
Yeah.
You know, just make it tailor-made.
Yeah, you're right. You're 100% right, and that's what we've done. And I think if things go well, we'll be shooting that movie before the year ends.
Yeah, so one of the things we want to talk about is, like, if there's anything like exciting that you're working on right now, so you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I was mentioning earlier, I just did a show, it's called Full Circle, and it's on DirecTV. DirecTV has a channel called the Audience Network, and this is their third season, and it's an ensemble cast, and Raymond Cruz happened to be one of the actors that I work with, and boy, man, the episode that we have is super, super intense, man. And there I really got to know Raymond really, really well. And just a fabulous, fabulous actor and just a really, really great person. But yeah, that's one of the projects that air, I think, sometime in September. And it's a 10-episode, it's 10 episodes, they're 30-minute dramatic episodes. And each actor does about 3 to 4 episodes a piece. And as the story moves along, it's pretty much 2 actors per episode. And by the time you get to the 10th episode, the story comes full circle and it's told full circle. And it's told in a really, really creative way. It's a complete actor's piece where they literally set the cameras up in the room and they'd call action. And for the next 20 minutes, you'd be acting. It goes straight through. And it was a brutal experience, both physically, emotionally, mentally. One of the best jobs that I've had so far in terms of acting experience, but hopefully it'll turn out great, man. And it's something that'll definitely showcase us for sure. And but I, you know, and I'll tweet that stuff out too once I know the actual dates or whatever.
Yeah.
And then this project with my production company Wama Films, it's called The Wing Walker, and it's going to be an indie film, and it's going to focus on this young guy who's a widower who. His daughter needs a heart transplant, and 2 days, the day that he finds out, he ends up getting deported. So he'll be forced to plan the probably one of the most boldest border crossing plans in history.
All right, and that's your first writing credit too, right?
Yeah, that's going to be my first. Yeah, my first feature. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
sounds very exciting.
Yeah. So we're really excited about this one, and we've been working on it for a couple of years total, from concept to script. So we're getting really close.
Well, thanks for spending some time with us. We really appreciate it. I'm excited to see that stuff, and you know, hopefully you'll see him on another episode of Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely, man. And thank you guys so much. It was great to meet you guys in Albuquerque, and the fact that we got a chance to do it is awesome.
It is. I would love to have I know that you know, Jenny Miguel, the people put it on. It was a strain on them because they're just, you know, regular type people. But there's been rumors of maybe bringing it back someday. That'd be fun.
Yeah, and it was surprising. I mean, for their first time, they did a great job. They treated us well, and we had a really good time. So
I agreed.
That's always exciting.
They definitely got my vote.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And much love to all the listeners too, man. I appreciate everyone that tunes in to you guys and allows us to kind of chat a little bit about these things. So
See what I'm telling you? He's such a nice guy, everybody. Max Arciniego.
They're sending it back your way, too. Everybody loves you. So
I appreciate that. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thanks for giving us the time, man.
You got it, man. And keep up the great work. And we'll talk again soon.
Yep, we'll
do it. Sounds good.
So once again, I'd like to thank Max for his time. If you would like to follow him on the internet and see what he's up to, he's on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's basically slash Max Arciniega for Facebook and at Max Arciniega for the others. I'll put those links in the show notes. And if you'd like to give him a shout out and tell him that you heard him on Bald Move, I think all would appreciate that. So again, thanks, Max, and we had a good time. Hey, everybody, this is the point in the podcast where I put all my post-it notes on the stairwell and I start begging for money. I'm trying to get out of the doghouse, which is my empty bank account, and appealing to you as patrons of the independent podcasting arts and as people presumably that enjoy our podcast. If you haven't done it already, please check out the club Bald Move at club.baldmove.com. I know you probably haven't checked it out yet because you're listening to this ad, and you wouldn't have to listen to the ad if you had the club access. So not only are you supporting, you know, keeping the lights on and the bits flowing here at Bald Move, but you also get special features like that, extra content in the form of podcasts and other fun things we do, and just the fact that we probably wouldn't be doing Better Call Saul if we weren't doing this as a full-time job, let alone the other stuff like House of Cards and Daredevil. And, you know, we could only really do one main podcast at a time and probably be The Walking Dead. So if you enjoy these extra podcasts we do, the only way we can do it is by staying full-time and working at this like a job. And you can help us do that by going to club.baldmove.com. If you are uninterested in that commitment and you shop on Amazon, please remember to use amazon.baldmove.com to get there. It'll automatically redirect you to Amazon, and anything you buy on that session will get a teeny tiny cut of. It doesn't cost you anything. It just helps us out, and we really appreciate it. Feedback, you can send this into bettercastsaul@baldmove.com or on the forums, forums.baldmove.com. Barry C. said, I'm surprised how much I enjoyed this episode. I had some excellent character building for Chuck and Kim, and if you'd have told me that we would hardly see Jimmy in an episode, I would have assumed that it would have sucked. I'm not even sure Breaking Bad could have carried an episode without Walt in the spotlight. I also found myself siding with Chuck and Kim a lot more, thinking Jimmy probably is a bad influence in their lives. Again, I couldn't see myself having a similar view of Walt this early in Breaking Bad, which is a real testament to the nuance of Better Call Saul. They're doing a lot with much smaller storylines, and I love it.
I don't know, season two Breaking Bad, you start to get into Walt shit.
Sure, but also, like, Peekaboo is a season two that like largely it's cared all about Jesse, Jesse. I'm thinking lots of stuff in season four where is this the Mike and Jesse show. So I don't know these, but I for sure if you'd have told me this was a Kim, like obviously this show can be carried on Mike's shoulders. But if you told me this
and
was
they've done it before.
This was a Kim special, like straight up, like at least a third of the episode was just her, I would have said, like, ooh, I don't know about that. But damn, Ray Seahorn is really good.
Yeah. And the writers know when they can press that, you know? They wouldn't have in season one given us an all Kim episode because we didn't know Kim well enough. She didn't have enough groundwork laid.
They are professional. Yeah. Here is the contra. And I've seen a lot of this in the fan base. Robert R. says, I'm getting a little down on season two of Saul and the rest of it going forward. I honestly think without the Breaking Bad Easter eggs and callbacks, this show would be boring. So many times now an episode has...
Come on, a Chicago sunroof. There's nothing boring about that.
So many times now an episode has sort of dragged on and then only a tease of some of the promised land of when does this get more Breaking Bad-ish. The way this last season ended and they admitted they had to roll it back, that Jimmy was too close to Saul already, really makes the season feel like it's dragging out for the sake of dragging out. I'm getting a little bored with how the show you the ending trope is being used in the show, and then proceeding to how did they get to that point intrigue. This entire series is based on that. Oh, Chuck had a nice wife and no disease. Wait till we show you how he got there. Oh, Saul's name is Jimmy. Wait till we show you what happened. Oh, Mike hasn't connected with Gus. Wait till we show you. Oh, Cartel Gramps is walking. Wait till we show you. Oh, Nacho wants to kill a guy, but who? It can't be Tuco because he lives. Wait till we show you.
Mike's face is beat in, and he has Tuco's chain. Wait till we show you what happens. The old, we like to paint ourselves in a corner thing, admittedly is a thing, but I'm starting to feel like this show is all made of corners. It feels like a little academic at times, as if Vince and company are too smart for their own good and they're entertaining themselves. They're too smart and time their cameos just perfectly to not make it feel like they're just fan servicing. But I find myself, in between those times, getting really bored. I thought this last episode was so boring, I couldn't deal with it. And then they drop Walking Gramps cameo right before the closing bell. Where the internet probably exploded like, oh crap, he's walking. But I still am picking my head up off the table from watching him make phone calls and highlight line items for 30 minutes of the episode. Kim, rather, not him.
Okay.
Without the corners you want to see unpainted, and without the satisfying cameos of our faves and Easter eggs of Breaking Bad universe, is this show boring? I think Mad Men is one of the greatest shows of all time, and it is objectively boring in the sense of...
For like, most of it, yeah.
I mean, boring in the sense that there's hardly any action in the plot. It's all about change
dialogue
of characters.
And, yeah.
And I think that stuff is fascinating. I think it's fascinating, and it depends on what type of show you're wanting to watch, and I'm not making a judgment here, but if you like to watch people's faces and get subtle nuances and what's going on behind their eyes, and I think I put forth the case that I'm one of those people in this episode, then I think this stuff is super entertaining. I thought last night's right. episode was much better than I thought it was going to be based on what I knew about it. What's your read on this?
Yeah, I almost universally disagree with him. I think, yes, if you're expecting Breaking Bad and this show to be exactly that, maybe you're going to be a little disappointed. But Breaking Bad has that innate hook of Mr. Chips to Scarface, of a man who has nothing left to lose.
Uh-huh.
And I don't feel like Better Call Saul started with that hook in the way that Breaking Bad did.
No.
Better Call Saul has been more of an ensemble character thing, whereas Breaking Bad was a very focused look at one man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're different shows, and I like certainly that could upset people or just make them like, I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm just saying it is a very different thing.
No, and I do feel like there is a part of the Breaking Bad fan base that are getting a little testy. Like,
right.
They want the fulminated mercury, damn it.
They
want the
acid
baths.
And that's not even really their own fault. I mean, this is the Breaking Bad universe.
Sure.
It's just a different show. And the part where I do completely agree with him, I think these cameos are getting a bit too much.
Oh, see?
I think we're being shown a few too many of like the wink and nod characters.
But does it make
back like, to back to back? I mean, it's 3 weeks in a row now.
I get it.
Cameo,
but,
cameo, cameo.
But you can't say, oh, we need to space out the cameo. I mean, they have to serve the needs of the story. And I think these are like, it makes perfect sense that.
Right. No,
Nacho would go to Mike, and then that would drag him to Tuco. And then Hector, of course, his favorite nephew, he would come out swinging for him. Like
I guess just week after week, it's a little too much.
But
for me.
Why is it too much?
Because they're strung week back to back to back.
But that's like saying I had meat yesterday and I had meat today, and I just last thing I want to eat is meat. Like
that's 100% like a thing.
But if these were like,
I mean, now it's weird for me to say that given my Chipotle habit.
That's
but.
What I'm saying. Yeah, like you're fucking, you know, 24/7 burrito man. But what I'm saying is, if these characters weren't on Breaking Bad, you wouldn't bat your eye.
Right, of course.
So why the fact that they used to be on Breaking Bad are they?
I feel like maybe they could just ration it a little better.
But I don't know other than it's. You know, I don't know what logical argument you're making. I guess it's a subjective argument.
It's not a logical argument. Yeah, it's just a feeling I have of like, they're hitting me with all these Breaking Bad characters.
If it was like, you know, what I didn't like is now that I've seen this season, I really like the Tuco cameo in season one worse. Because there was no reason he needed to be in that. He could establish Nacho. Right. Nacho could have been working for Tuco. We'd recognize the name. But Saul randomly knocking or, you know, them randomly.
Yeah. No, we both had a problem with that. I still have a problem with it. It's...
This stuff is not coincidental, though. So I have no problems with it. As long as they're not, you know, this isn't Chewbacca meeting Yoda just because. This was a logical sequence of events that makes perfect sense given what we know where these characters are at in the Breaking Bad era.
Just a little Fast and Furious for me.
I'm worried because I think we're going to get this second half from what I, you know, I almost feel like we need a spoiler section. Because if you watch the next scene next week on, and I don't think you did.
No.
There are more cameos coming.
Really?
Yep. And I honestly don't Christ. Understand your perspective on it.
Okay.
I get it. I understand it, but I just, I don't agree.
Yeah, you don't feel the same way.
That's fine. Doesn't feel gratuitous.
That's fine. I don't feel the same way about this show being boring and slow. So, as the emailer does.
All right, so there you go, Robert. Michael P. said, when Tio first showed up on the diner, I was ready to call bullshit. Then I realized how much sense it makes. Of course Tio would do something like this if he wasn't confined to his wheelchair. Maybe Mike's future struggle with the Salamanca cartel will be what gets Mike on Gus's good side. Who knows? Maybe Mike will somehow lead to Tio's stroke. That would definitely get Gus on the Ehrman Trout bandwagon. And I guess that's my thing, too. When he walked in, I didn't roll my eye. My first reaction was, of course, and shit, what's Mike going to do? So, I don't know.
My first reaction was, another cameo? Okay.
But you just got to stop thinking about them as cameos, I think.
I know, they're introduction of characters that this we just happen
Leonard
to know.
This isn't Leonard Nimoy playing old Spock in A New Start. That's a cameo. This is reintroducing a character in the world they live in.
I understand. Okay. It's not my personal preference.
Yeah, well, like I said, buckle up, man.
God.
Mike H. Says, this isn't so much as a
criticism. Is Jesse in the next episode?
Aaron Paul, it's actually Jimmy goes into an outreach program at school, and he sits in on Walter White teaching chemistry lesson.
To Walt Jr.
And Jesse is the student that's failing. And he's like, okay. Well, how can I get through to you? It's that kind of stuff.
And then Skyler comes in.
Sure.
With Walter Jr. in tow. Uh-huh. Hank stops in to say, hey, we got a gas mask problem.
Skyler comes in and says, Walt, I need you to pick up bacon on the way home from school. And Junior comes stumbling in. Did someone say bacon? And then, Hank puts on a DEA, just say no. And there's a musical number. And right in at the climax, two jets slam into each other above the school.
Vince Gilligan winks at the screen. Waka waka.
He let Gould do that.
Okay. Right, that's fair. He's the showrunner.
Mike Gates says, this isn't so much a criticism as a general storytelling question. I often find myself confused by how much screen time is devoted to Jimmy or Mike, depending on the episode. To be clear, I love both characters and the stories they're telling. I'm just not sure who this story is supposed to be about. Obviously, all shows have more than one character, but is it normal to make two of them the focus of the series when they are so tenuously connected? I know that Saul and Mike work together in the world of Breaking Bad, but I wouldn't have ever called them partners or friends. And I get that thematically both characters are dealing with the idea of how dark they're willing to go, but is that enough of a connection to feature Mike so heavily? Or are the writers just trying to make the show exciting because they don't think Jimmy and Saul could keep fans interested? Considering all that, I can't help but wonder who this show is, and this seems like clunky storytelling at times. Having to split the plot of the episode between the two characters lessens each character's own interesting story. Jim, what are your thoughts?
I would question whether or not he felt that way about Breaking Bad, because a lot of the time, Breaking Bad was about Walt and Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see a huge difference here, other than, you know, they're not inextricably drawn together by this operation they've got going. Mike is kind of his own entity in this, in a way that Jesse wasn't.
Well, and you know, and I was, we touched on this a little bit with talking to Max, is that I'm starting increasingly to see Breaking Bad Better Call Saul as a story of continuing the work of Breaking Bad. It's a story of change. And how things change from one to the other, and from my perspective, chemistry. I'd love to see more of Mike and like how he turns into the man he is, and also, Jimmy obviously, but like I wouldn't mind seeing Crazy Eight. How does he get to be from the guy who's working at his father's furniture store to the guy who's fighting dogs and slinging drugs and right. threatening to kill people? And I'm trying to think other.
I mean, it's the problem because like, ultimately. I think like everybody Gus. Wants to see the Mike story,
sure.
too.
But how we bring Gus. Do we want to see Gus where he turns from errand boy to the cartel to the guy who's ready to seek his vengeance. Like, do we get a little bit of that? I mean, I felt right. we saw that in Breaking Bad, but you know what I mean?
That's what I mean. Like, ultimately, we want to know. We flash back in time. We want to know the origins of all of these characters.
Yes.
Is it? Does he have a problem just with the how early on in this process Mike got involved with Jimmy?
I mean,
I understand maybe that this is called Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
Not Better Call Mike. And mm-hmm. that you may want to see a lot more of Saul slash Jimmy, but I don't think I haven't felt slighted in the amount of Jimmy time we've got.
Me either. I mean, now that you spend half of an episode dealing with Kim and her arc, I could see people starting to be like, huh. To me, I'm just trying to say, like, I see where they're coming from. But I
do
guess,
too. I mean, Mike's.
I don't have a preconceived notion. In fact, I thought the show was going to be a disaster, if I'm being honest. And I think right. I'm on record as saying I'm very leery about this. But I trusted Vince and Peter Gould, and my faith has been rewarded. So, like, to me, I'm doubling down on the faith issue. I'm having a ball with the season.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they originally wanted to tell the story of Jimmy to Saul. They found out that that was a more interesting story. And also, there's so much more interesting things going on with Mike. And as... it's a temptation to keep blowing up and like, oh, and just keeping down these rabbit holes and lose sight of where you're going.
Right.
But if they do that, that would be kind of amazing if they fall into that trap because they are so thoughtful with the way they deal with their own show. So
I agree.
If I think it's fair to say that this show might devolve into where it's not your personal taste as a Breaking Bad fan, but it's not the same as saying the show is a failure of structure and storytelling.
Right, and I guess ultimately, how much do you want the show to also stand on its own? If you want that, you need a complex, rich stable of characters. And I think they've got that going. I do understand maybe the criticism of a little too much Mike, because Mike is not tied to Jimmy in the same way that
sure.
like Chuck and Kim. And like you want to see those stories because you care about Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he relates to those people is important. Mm-hmm. In the way they relate to him, whereas Mike is kind of out doing his own thing at the moment.
And we know he eventually will be doing more of his own thing.
Yeah. So this, I mean, it really could be called Better Call Saul and maybe Mike.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, I think this is going to be the story of both of them.
Right.
For a large chunk of it.
I mean, it could honestly be called Breaking Bad Year One.
Sure.
Like, you know, Batman Origin style.
Yeah.
Jeff W. has some thoughts about Jimmy and Chuck's childhood. So get ready for some fan fiction.
Let's do it.
I bet Chuck was one of those kids that always followed the rules, read lots of books, studied hard, and probably tattled on the rule breakers. In other words, the kind of kid that gets picked on and isolated. While I bet Jimmy is one of those kids who had a smooth tongue and learned how to get what he wanted and how to get out of trouble by telling fibs and sweet-talking people. In other words, a very popular kid. I also bet these two personalities reinforced each other. Chuck probably resented the hell out of Jimmy. I don't think that's a probably. He resents the hell out of Jimmy. His brother was popular, got attention without doing hard work, so this made Chuck an even bigger hard ass for following the rules. Big surprise, he becomes a lawyer. Now he's a prestigious and powerful one.
Can you imagine playing D&D with Chuck? Talk about rules lawyer.
Plus, he's one of those lawful good types that are just fucking pains in the party's asses.
You can never get any gold. You never get any items. You're always giving shit away.
Yeah,
what?
It's terrible.
Come on.
It's a chaotic goods way to, if you want to play a good character. Jimmy probably felt intimidated by Chuck's intellect and success, and so instead of trying to apply himself, he takes shortcuts to success. He becomes Slipping Jimmy. Now as adults, Chuck has formed an identity that is nothing like Jimmy, which I'd say is why he is so opposed to Jimmy being a lawyer. He loves his brother so long as he remains a lovable screw-up and not a peer. For Jimmy, I can only imagine what it meant for him to earn a law degree and pass the bar. He finally earned success without shortcuts, just hard work, and Chuck's betrayal must have killed him. And now he's retreating back to the only identity he knows, telling lies and taking shortcuts. I think that's pretty right on. The only thing I'd like to understand more is their relationship with their father.
Yeah.
I feel like that's going to be a key revelation going down. There's two things. What was their, what was this relationship with their father about, and what's their true story behind the store front, and what the hell happened to Chuck?
I think we'll see those.
Those
flashbacks.
Are the two central mysteries in the show right now. I don't know that you. Well, I mean, I didn't expect to see a cousin's flashback of Tio drowning him to teach him a lesson. So like, I'm like, come on, this show's not going to do little Chuck and little. And I'm like, oh fuck, they have. before. So,
but also, I feel like that maybe gives away too much. If you just straight up show the events, I think it's more interesting to look at them through the perspective of these two men.
Yeah, I mean, I can...
And maybe have them discuss it. Maybe they have an argument about it.
Like, but I need someone to admit someone's point of view is wrong and someone's point of view is right. If they're maybe Jimmy will be like, you're right, I did steal. Mm-hmm. I saw it as a victimless crime and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't know where this is going, but I do feel like we can't just get the one guy's side of the story and not the other and also be left to guess who's telling the truth and who's not. I don't know if it's a flashback.
I mean, maybe,
I don't know if that's an emotional confrontation. I don't know if that's documents that Chuck finds about how the store really... I don't know what it looks
Here's
like.
Here's the problem with an emotional confrontation is now I don't know if Jimmy's telling the truth or just trying to get Chuck's goat. Because
that's why I say someone has to fucking confess eventually.
Even with a confession, I don't know if, like, it depends on how they film it, probably, and where the character is coming from in that moment.
Is this the Making of a Murderer podcast? Come on.
No, but him trying to get Chuck to commit extortion, right?
Sure.
Like, saying all these things, like, just admitting to Chuck what he wants to hear because that's what Chuck wants to hear. Who says he's not doing that if he admits, yeah, I stole the money? So maybe at some point, like, they've written themselves into such a complicated
thing. But Jimmy wasn't offering to change his view of the universe. He was offering to capitulate to Chuck through an action. That's different
than
saying...
But you don't think that he would admit to something that he didn't do to
get
the same effect?
So, like, Jimmy's like, oh, you want to believe I stole from Dad? Fine, I stole from Dad. Like, that's not...
Exactly, that's not really...
What I'm saying is...
So it depends on how they portray it, I guess.
And I'm saying that I need to portray a genuine, uncoerced confession.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Or I need to know the truth, because I hate... And then you can spend time letting the audience try to figure out, but you got to reveal the answer
eventually.
Like, you can't, like, Chris. I don't feel like you can get away with the Christopher Nolan style spinning top and fade to black on this issue.
It's just gonna hear a gunshot,
right?
Fade to
because
black,
this isn't about plot. This is about the characters.
Uh-huh.
So you can't really leave us guessing about that. I don't think. Law Talk. You ready for Law Talk?
Yes, I love Law Talk.
Doug Ells.
Let's do it.
Talking about Jimmy's hearing date. Jimmy and his babysitter take a trip to court to ask for a hearing date on a motion for summary judgment, which this show got completely wrong.
What?
A motion is a written request for the court to do something, but the way the motion works is you file the motion, the other side gets due process right to oppose your motion, then you get one last chance to file a reply to address any new issues or arguments raised by the opponent. All of these three briefs are filed to the court, and they will read them, consider them, and then hold a hearing where the attorneys can argue their positions, and the court will decide whether or not to grant the request.
So he skipped the whole letting them know.
Well, that's
thing.
He said this process takes time. The amount of time required is spelled out in applicable statutes. In New Mexico, for example, if you file a motion for summary judgment, the other side is given 15 days to oppose, and then you are given 15 days to write a response. Which means Jimmy requesting a hearing date on Thursday would be completely unrealistic. He'd need a hearing date at least a month away, but probably longer to give him time to file the motion and the court time to read and digest the materials after it all comes in. More importantly, selecting this hearing date would be something that Omar would do by talking to the clerk over the phone. There would be no need for Jimmy to drive an hour from Santa Fe to do it. Unless he was delivering a Beanie Baby. But then again, the whole reason he's trying to hustle this along is to get it for this week, which is bullshit.
Yeah. Right.
And again, this make no mistake, this is calibrating dilithium crystals.
Sure.
So, like...
This is hand-waving.
The reason he brings this up is, in general, when TV shows screw up legal issues, the most common mistake they make is to dramatically shorten timetables. A client walks into Alan McBeal's office, and they seem to have a verdict within the next day or two, which is simply not how law works. True.
Yeah.
But if you're doing a TV show,
you can't have one case last 2-3 years.
Continuances and discovery and changing, and oh, now my lawyer's gone on vacation, and oh, now the judge is.
Your whole show would be one case.
And oh, the prosecuting attorney just, you know, it switched and he wants to review the. It's like that shit would be terrible. Terrible TV.
Yeah.
And again, they're just flipping, they're just inverting the polarity of the tachyon beams here.
Uh huh.
The reformed Ivy Leaguer comes back and's got some observations. He said on the subject of stupid styles, you'd think that content is the only thing that matters, but partners really get annoyed if an associate fails to use the appropriate typography. I saw a partner toss a brief in the trash can because the associate failed to use the firm's approved style.
I have heard of this being a thing.
Dude,
so it didn't surprise me at all.
I've worked in programming shops where
you better indent correctly,
you
the
better
right
tab
amount of spaces.
And not five spaces, or you better set your tab to be five spaces, and you better camel case and and you can get in serious. Like, I didn't like working for those places, but sure. You know, I also don't like accounting for my time in like 5 minute increments, which I know is a lot of what lawyers do.
Yeah.
Anyway, on the unbelievable side, he thought the hierarchy, nowhere on this green planet does a second year associate tell a fourth year associate what to do. The reason for this is the associates need to bill hours to get their bonus and to keep their jobs. Partners typically give their cases to more senior associates to manage on the day-to-day. The mid-level senior associate then decides which junior associates, first or second years, get to eat. If you're a crappy or annoying junior associate, then you don't eat and you die. Firms are pretty much the modern version of the Hunger Games. You need hours to survive. So if you're a junior associate, you kiss up the mid-levels.
Wait, this is like Justin Timberlake in, what, In Time?
Is In Time, yeah. You got to touch your mom's forearm in the second, and she's going to die.
Yep.
If you are a mid-level associate, then you kiss up to your senior associate. If you're a senior associate, you kiss up to the partner. The more logical move, to be realistic, is for them to assign a ball-busting seventh or eighth-year associate who has good judgment to do the babysitting, not an experienced junior associate who might get retribution on some other case. Fair point.
So maybe that indicates a little bit about it being more punitive, right?
Could be.
Like almost a slap in the face to Jimmy.
And also they don't take him seriously. Like he's not on the partner track anymore?
Good question.
Can
you change that midstream? I assume you can.
I guess.
It seems like they might have with Kim. So.
Or maybe they just don't think much of Aaron and she's just an annoying go-getter that they're, you know. Who knows what the politics are. Kim still being in the doghouse. This is kind of on a borderline. A fourth-year associate pulling a big client like this is super improbable, but the writers do a good job of conveying that since you see Kim dialing hours and hours with no results.
Yeah.
But if you did pull the Holy Grail, I can't see them keeping you in the basement. Why? Because, one, you could leave the firm and just take that new client to your new firm since you have the relationship, or the client who hired HHM will expect Kim to stay on the case at least tangentially.
She's the face of the
which
case.
Which is all things I thought when I was watching this. Like,
right.
Howard is really banking on Kim being ride or die for this firm to treat her this way.
Well, it's the same as what they did with Jimmy and the Sandpiper case, right?
Yeah.
Like, all of the old people involved in this case love him, and he needs to be the face of HHM for them.
This is even more because it's a big, prestigious bank, and she's got a, you know, like, hugs and kisses kind of personal relationship with the person who got the lead. Kim and Jimmy both being fourth-year associates, please. First, I wrote you a few weeks ago about how absurd it was that Jimmy received a Mercedes. My position's even stronger now that Kim is a fourth-year associate at arguably the better firm. Do you see Kim in a Mercedes? No. My wife next tells me that Kim is an associate at HH&M while Jimmy was in law school. If that's correct, then she has to be 1 or 3 years ahead of him in legal practice. Mathematically, I can't see how she's the same grade level associate.
Yeah.
I don't want to start a marital fight,
but
I think your wife is wrong. They were both in the...
He was in the mailroom.
The show was she.
She was in the mailroom, too?
Yeah, I believe.
Okay.
And he
talks
about being
any
in the mailroom. He says
evidence.
There's a guy and there is a girl. No, I'm pretty sure
he met a girl, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that she was. Huh. And also, she says, Howard says she's a, or Chuck says she's a fourth year.
Right, right. And so, that was the confusion there. How can they both be fourth year?
Yeah, I felt like the show established that.
Maybe
they both passed the bar very quickly and both were made lawyers.
I bet her degree is from somewhere nicer than American.
It's not
Samoa.
For a place that has a banana slug for a mascot. That's all of Law Talk. Chong
okay.
Chong. If you'd like to send us feedback, do it at bettercastsaul@baldmove.com or on forums.baldmove.com. Thanks again for everybody listening. Thanks for Max for being on our show and being gracious at this time. We'll be back next week.
Yeah, for 206. We're more than halfway through now.
Yeah, crazy.
So we'll see you then.
Bye-bye.